to another episode of the LED Cast, brought to you by MesoPartner. MesoPartner is an international consultancy firm that generates and disseminates knowledge in the field of territorial development. For more information on this and other episodes, visit mesopartner.com and click on the LED Cast button. In this episode, Christian Schoon of MesoPartner interviews Dr. Christian von Lübcke of the Stanford University. They discuss the political economy and specifically try to understand why do some district governments in Indonesia perform so much better than others.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Nice to talk to you today. We have interesting topics that we agreed upon to talk about, particularly with regard to your research projects in Indonesia. But let's start with introducing yourself, please.
My name is Christian von Lübcke. I'm a research fellow at the Asia Pacific Research Center here at Stanford University. Currently, I'm working on a book project which analyzes the drivers of economic governance and business climates, particularly in post-Suharto Indonesia. And professionally, before I came back to academia, I was working for GTZ and the World Bank between 2001 and 2008, and particularly focusing on issues of local economic development, local governance, and investment climate promotion. So, yeah, I'm very happy to be here and having this interview.
Okay, great. Thanks for this overview. You are doing research, particularly in Asia, Southeast Asia, as I understand, or East Asia, with a special focus on Indonesia. And
that's
this
right.
Was also the country where we met first and also did some work together, PACA implementation back in 2003.
Mm-hmm.
Just give us a short overview about your research projects in the last few years in Indonesia, please.
Yeah, well, over the last 5 years, I've been strongly involved in two comparative local governance studies which are of particular relevance to the topic today. The first one, which also became the basis of my PhD research, was conducted between 2005 and 2007 and focused mainly on the drivers of good governance, with particularly focusing on aspects of government leadership, societal pressures, and you could say reform-enhancing structures of good governance, and involving both controlled case studies and large N data sets to triangulate case findings, which, yeah, were based on questionnaires with 1,000 small and medium firms and, yeah, about 130 in-depth interviews with public and private stakeholders. The second one, which I'd like to talk about today, is a study which I did together with two dear colleagues, Neil McCulloch at IDS, the Institute for Development Studies, and Arianto Patunro from the University of Indonesia. This was a project which was part of an international research collaboration at IDS, particularly the Center of the Future State, on public action and private investment. And what we tried to do is have a look at how public-private relations, so interaction between the government and the private sector, have affected investment activities and investment climate reforms, particularly looking at emerging economies like Egypt, Brazil, China, Pakistan, and Indonesia. And in our case, in Indonesia, Neil, Adianto, and me, we looked at two cities in particular, Solo and Manado, in the year 2008.
All these research projects need to be seen against the background of the current decentralization process. In fact, it's already going on since 2001, I think. Decentralization in Indonesia to empower the districts and give power and autonomy from the central level and also the provincial level down to the district level. And it also needs to be seen in the light of democratization, which is also moving forward. So this context is particularly important. Just give us a short overview of the context in Indonesia.
Yes, Christian. I mean, as you outlined, this democratic decentralization reform in Indonesia has been a very remarkable and very rapid regime shift, maybe one of the most rapid in recent history. And after the Asian crisis and the stepping down of General Suharto in 98, Indonesia put an end to 30 years of authoritarian rule and a rather centralistic regime, and moved on to implement far-reaching political and administrative reforms. Roughly, as you mentioned, there are three fair and free elections since 99, where Indonesian citizens have elected more than, I would estimate, 1,500 national representatives, the DPR in Jakarta, and over 30,000 local council members across 450 districts. And each of these districts have elected subnational government heads, mayors, and Bupati and Wali Kota, as they're called in Indonesian, which probably add up to over 800 over the last 10 years. So, yeah, moreover, local taxes and services used to be coordinated centrally in Jakarta, but this is not longer the case. Now they're managed autonomously in 450 district governments across the archipelago. So if we sum all this up, it's fair to say that in a rather short period of time, Indonesia has transformed into one of the largest and, I would argue, administratively most decentralized democracies in the world.
Okay. That's really remarkable and hugely interesting.
Yeah, I mean, we should maybe add that these are service responsibilities. If we look at the financial part of the story, it's fair to say that still 90% of these local government budgets still accrue from national transfers from the DAU, DAK. So the own local revenue of these local districts, the Pendapatan Asli Daerah, is still roughly only 10% on average. But nonetheless, I mean, Indonesia is still a very unique case in terms of its speed and scope of decentralization and democratization since 99.
Just one question in between. You just mentioned about the financial side and here the revenue side, that 19% of the revenues are accrued at the national level, only 10% at the local level. What about the expenditure side? Do you have estimates for that?
Well,
what about the public expenditure at the national level versus the district level or the local level?
Although I don't have clear data on the expenditure side, it's clear that that service responsibilities have tremendously been shifted downward. So, the local services for health, education, infrastructure, local economic development, promotion, all these local level services are now mainly provided by local districts, not provincial levels, but actually the districts themselves. So there's a bit of a gap of the responsibility burden and the financial capacity in these local districts, which has been leading to lots of debates, and some people argue that the property taxes should actually be decentralized in the coming years. But that's a hard reform to take, I assume, so it will probably take time.
All right. So let's look now particularly at the local level. We are interested at the local level. You know, we work on the local level, and your research projects also mainly focus on the local level and what is happening there in the context of decentralization. So the first of the two projects you mentioned before is about good governance, governance at the local level, and trying to find out what are the underlying reasons and the underlying incentives for good governance. You mentioned before that you analyzed the drivers of good governance at the local level. Can you just give us some idea what are typical drivers of good governance?
So today, you could say the paradigm revolves something around good governance means moving governments closer to people and markets. So decentralization and democracy promotion, also private sector development, has become the mantra. And Yeah, connected to, this is to cut a long story short, connected to this background, I was very interested to look at how the situation unfolded in Indonesia. And Indonesia and many other emerging democracies and emerging economies, they might have not traveled as far as some advanced economies in the West. So the question is, where do they stand and how important are, let's say, supply side factors, the internal drivers from within the government, we could call it government leadership, and how important are the demand side factors, the external pressures from society, which I refer to as societal pressure, in explaining these differences in local governance. So these are the two factors, namely government leadership and societal pressure, which I am testing in my research.
Okay, for better understanding, mm-hmm. When you talk about governance, are you talking about government or you're talking about governance in general? So are you equating governance with government?
Well, there are different definitions.
Yes, and that's why I asked the definition we use here.
I mean, if I look at good governance and the new definitions which are revolving around good governance, I mean, mm-hmm. as I said, there's a strong focus on private sector societal pressure arguments in recent mm-hmm. literatures. If you see that, governance has to equate to the interactions of both sides, of government and society. It's the policies that result from an interactive process, because if it would only be government itself, then you would somehow exclude the other side of the equation, namely the society.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. So we include that in this definition. Okay. So, all right, so you did in your local governance, good governance study, and trying to find out what is basically determining governance in Indonesian districts. You did research at the district level, and you looked obviously at various districts and various provinces or various parts of the country. Just in a nutshell, without going too much into detail, what methodology did you use?
Well, before I get to that, let me just add the good governance, I mean, is basically the quality of local government performance. I mean, what's the outcome of the interactive process of government and different other groups? And the basic question we're looking at is, why do some local governments perform better than others? Why are the outcomes, I mean, what are the drivers that really affect these outcomes? And in the research I would like to talk about today is I basically applied a mixed method approach which triangulates qualitative case studies of, in my first study, 8 districts, and in the second collaborative study of 2 cities, which involves both in-depth interviews with local stakeholders and questionnaires, local business surveys, with small and medium firms, and then triangulates them with available data sets, so running some regressions of a large N scale. And as I tried to outline before, I mean, the two factors that I'm interested in is, for one, is reform agency. So, I mean, how much do societal pressure and leadership pressures explain the great and the vast variation that we see nowadays in subnational government performance in Indonesia. Mm-hmm. And secondly, are there any, beyond the agency dimension, are there any reform-enhancing structures, something about the composition of the economy and the society which explains these variations? So it's part an agency and part a structural discussion. In order to trace the different impact, the different effect of societal pressure and government leadership in this first study, is to have a specific case selection. So what I did is I focused on specific district pairs. So I would choose four district pairs in four Indonesian provinces, and each of these pairs were somewhat controlling for culture because they were located in the same province, but they were also selected in a way, these two districts in each province, that they were more or less identical in social economic factors, including population, GDP, political structures, religious affiliation, poverty, education, and so forth. But at the same time, they were distinct in the variable of interest. So let's say in one pair, although they were more or less the same, they were distinctly different in the degree and the quality of government leadership, and another pair, they would be distinctly different in the presence of societal pressure. So now, how did I measure that? There are certain data sets available in Indonesia which identify the efforts of local district heads in eradicating corruption. And there's also available news reports on corruption allegations. So in the leadership cases, I would select one district, which a Bupati, a district head, which has been in the news for his great efforts of eradicating extortion, whereas the other one was in the news for corruption allegations of embezzling public funds, and that was also confirmed by the survey data. And for the societal pressure cases, we can look at indicators for education, for the presence of associations, and for political awareness, and choose two districts which are more or less the same but distinctly different in the societal pressure indicators. And by doing so, if we then have these distinct pairs, and then later on go into these districts and analyze the local government's indicators, the performance indicators, we can then link variation of these underlying factors, leadership and societal pressure, to observable differences in government performance, and then draw conclusions from that. So that's the basic setting for the research.
Yes, this is a methodology, and now we look at the conclusions, at the outcome of this research project. And you you already formulated some minutes ago this basic question, this lead question that you wanted to answer with this project, namely, why do some district governments in Indonesia perform well, while others perform poorly? So how would you answer this question?
Well, this might come to a surprise for some of the development analysts in far away from Indonesia, but less to a surprise for those which are long involved in Indonesian studies. Well, the answer is, in the early transition period, and I mean, I have to emphasize that this research took place in 2005 to 2007, so it's a snapshot of eight districts, as I said, four district pairs, two looking at leadership and two looking at societal pressure. What I find is that the districts which were chosen for their distinctiveness in leadership, they show a clear alignment of good leadership measured in aspects of corruption, efforts of these district heads of corruption eradication, and also their skills to forge coalitions, their popularity levels, their communication skills across different parts of the bureaucracy, so different leadership skills. So the alignment is clear between good government leadership and positive governance outcomes. So what we find in these four districts, in these two pairs which have distinct leadership differences, is that factors of one-stop licensing service are distinctly better in the good government leadership cases. And also we find that corruption, for example, corruption of public recruitment in Indonesia, there's quite a strong tendency that some candidates for public servant positions are inclined or asked to pay certain inducements in order to take their position. And Interestingly, during my research, I asked 10 non-government respondents in each of these districts to estimate, to give a broad estimate of these payments that some people are willing to pay or are asked to pay. And not only did people confirm these tendencies, they also gave a rather clear estimate. And based on these estimates, I could calculate an average in each of these 8 districts. And it's quite surprising. These averages range from 0 million rupiah to roughly 65 million rupiah in another district. And interestingly, they are lower in those districts which are also connected to higher leadership. Whereas the societal pressure cases...
May I just ask one question in between? Yes. Because it's very interesting. 65 million rupiah for getting a certain job, basically, a government position, to buy this government position, of course, also needs to be measured against the monthly income of government officials. So how much would a government official, maybe one who is paying 65 million for such a job, earn per month? So what is the return on investment? Or basically, where's the break even one day?
That's a very good question. The average income is more or less, for an incoming public servant, is more or less 1 million. So 1 million right now is roughly $100. So it's in Western terms, it doesn't sound like much, but it's quite a lot of money for Indonesian rural district terms. And so in other words, this is perception-based data, and of course, these are indications that some people do that, but many others, of course, still take the exams. But some of them are willing to pay 65 million rupiahs, and that means they invest 65 monthly salaries. That's 5 years of their working incomes. And that's quite fascinating to me as well.
Yeah, it is indeed.
And it tells you something about the rural societal structure, where working at the government is still seen as a major dream or the best kind of employment, and private sector employment is only ranking after that.
Right. Okay, now you wanted to continue with the societal pressure part.
Yes, so, I mean, as I outlined, there are different indicators we looked at. One was the quality of administrative service, looking at one-stop shops, which I'll come back later. One is looking at the degree of corruption, and one of the more illustrative indicators which I outlined was this, the degree of public recruitment corruption. And while we see an alignment of low corruption and good leadership, we don't find this alignment so much in our societal pressure cases. So the districts which stand out for high associational presence, for strong education and public political awareness, they are not necessarily connected to lower levels of public recruitment corruption. So we find a rather mixed picture here. And this mixed picture also continues in the administrative quality. So if in each of these districts we visited, that is me and local students, we visited without announcing our visits, we visited these one-stop shops, and they're quite an innovative new feature in local governments, as you know. I mean, these governments have introduced an integrative service unit, you can say, which streamlines all the administrative requirements for business licenses and birth certificates in one shop. So people can now go, instead of lining up for hours at these different departments, they can go to one point and receive all their license and birth certificates. Now, at these unannounced visits, it's quite fascinating to see the differences. So in some of these districts, we had large problems to even find the place, and ended up in a dark space somewhere in the Bupati, in the district head building, which was rather dusty, and two people were reading newspapers, some old typewriters sitting at the end of the room, and people could not answer any of our questions and said, well, we don't really know how long it takes to get your license. We better to go to the departments themselves. Where in other districts, you would come into a bright room with very clear, transparent information brochures and information on the wall, friendly staff and counters which would actually really serve you, and suggestion boxes in the corner, and people would really provide you what we might call a customer-oriented service. So vast differences. And again, if we compare these differences across these cases, the good leadership cases clearly were connected to also better administrative quality, whereas the societal pressure cases provide once again a mixed picture. In one pair, it was pretty much an alignment. In the other pair, it was the opposite. So the high societal pressure was providing the lower administrative services. And overall, there were five indicators. I mean, I outlined the public recruitment, corruption, and the administrative quality. There were also, we also looked at the quality of local regulations, how much the new local tax bills distort trade or not. We looked at the administrative efficiency, how long does it take to get your necessary business licenses. And also another corruption indicator, this is the fifth indicator, how much do you have to pay unofficial fees for attaining actually your normal industry or trade or handicraft permit. So across all these five indicators, again, the story holds that the alignment is much stronger in the pairs with distinctive leadership. Namely, good leadership is linked to better local government performance, whereas stronger societal pressure measured in the presence of associations, education, and political awareness, provides a rather mixed picture. So we see we have mixed results.
Regarding local leadership and good, strong local leadership, what actually are the, what is the motivation, what are the incentives for district leaders, bupatis in Indonesian language, or also the mayors of the cities to perform strongly in a good leadership way? Why would, why would they do this?
That's a very good question. I would argue, well, it's clear that these bupati and walikota, these district heads and mayors, have been historically quite strong, so power is not the issue. I mean, they have been set in place from the Dutch colonial powers. I mean, aristocrats for in the Dutch colonial days have been positioned in these high bureaucratic positions, and decentralization has given them over the last years more administrative responsibilities and power to really affect local policy and to supervise local bureaucracies. But the interesting question, as you mentioned, is why should they care? I mean, why should they really be interested in policy reform and to improving the local business climate? And here I would say that institutions kick in. I mean, we do have a huge formal institutional regime change. So we have democratic rules. Since 2005, these bupati and walikota are no longer placed by the local parliament, but they're actually directly elected by the local constituencies of each district or city. So we have first-past-the-post Metatorian rule elections, which places these local leaders under much more scrutiny, much more public opinion and attention, media. So there is an incentive from the electoral part. Then there, another incentive you could argue is, with all these rapid decentralization changes, as you know, there are a lot of donor programs which have emerged in Indonesia over the last years.
Right.
And
I'm hardly working with this.
Exactly. So some of these local district leaders have understood that running on a good governance platform, trying to be a mediator, an agent of change, also fares quite well with the donor community, and there is some extra funding and prestige to be won if you can jump on a platform like that. So I would argue that the donor funding is another interesting new incentive which has come up over the last years. And the third one, I would argue, is political advancement. Some of these good local leaders, especially in two of the districts I've been working in, namely in Kebumen and Solok in Central Java and West Sumatra, now they have been promoted to governor and vice governor, respectively. So some of these, let's say, outstanding leaders, which for whatever reason have started to promote good governance and pushed the reforms forward, have now been rewarded also politically or in terms of their career by moving one step up the ladder.
So can we assume that the Indonesian democratic decentralization process, the reforms that have been implemented within the last few years, that they actually are leading to an improvement in local governance? Would you answer this question with yes?
I would answer it with yes, but not the way some observers, especially those coming from, as I outlined in the beginning, from this very society and market-led development paradigm. Yes, societal pressure matters over the long run, but over the short run, we still see lots of obstacles in the way that societal pressure can affect the outcome of good governance. I mean, as I said before, the alignments of these case studies, those which are really distinct in strong societal pressure, are providing rather mixed results in the beginning. And some of the reasons here, let me allude to some of the reasons, are that after 30 years of a rather depolitical and controlled authoritarian setting under Suharto, it will need time for some of these forces to fully unfold. So in the interviews that I've conducted, many, many interviews across these districts, it's quite clear that small firms and also Chinese firms, some of them are larger, are really reluctant to engage actively in pushing or pressing for good governance reforms. I mean, they're just scared that if they stand out personally, they will be singled out and they have to feel bureaucratic retaliation and negative effects for their business or their families. And local NGOs, yes, some of them have really sent some promising impulses, but many of them, as you probably know, they are still dependent on government funding, and this is local government funding in many cases, because they, not all of them have links to international donors or international NGOs abroad. So they're also compromised in some of the impulses they're sending. Large firms, which in some countries, especially in advanced countries, have become a major driving force of reform, we have to see that those which were connected to construction and procurement and mining have a long history of rather tight and, in bracket, sometimes collusive relationships to local governments. And many of them might feel that sustaining these links is more beneficial to them than engaging in criticizing and scrutinizing the local government and pushing for, let's say, broad-based investment climate reform. So also the impulses from them really depend on the constellation of how these private sector agents are relates to the composition, the power balance, and the structure of these groups in these local governments. Has democracy improved local governments? Yes, but it has, at least in the first years, taken a path, a channel, which is maybe surprising to some observers. I would argue it has taken a channel through directly elected and devoted government leaders in this early stage, which then become a mediator, a bridge builder between the private sector and the government. And as I outlined before, there are certain incentives for these local leaders which have accelerated this process. So it's not so much a pure bottom-up process, and also not a clear top-down process. It's a new democratic channel which somehow stands in the middle of both, where some democratically committed leaders have become agents of change and forged reform coalitions between different parts of their polity to drive change.
So what you did in the first study was mainly looking at two drivers. In the mm-hmm. second study, you also include public-private cooperation and have a particular look at that. So how does relation-based governance influence the business sector, the business in general, how business goes, how doing business goes in a certain district? Give us a little insight about what means public-private cooperation at the district level in Indonesia.
Right. I mean, public-private cooperation is what we hope for. So it's connected to the good governance that we're hoping to find after some years. The interesting question is, if we say that there has been a new channel of good leadership, which has been a driving factor for the good governance, the question that many people raise is, well, leadership matters, but I mean, what creates better leadership? Are there any structural factors? Are there any things that we can see in the composition of a polity of a local district or city that would lead us to assume or hope that there will be better leadership or more public-private cooperation? And this leads to the second project, where we looked more at structural factors. We compared two cities which are more or less similar in their socioeconomic setup, namely Surakarta, sometimes called Solo, and Manado.
Yes.
And but what they were quite distinctly different was the character of their public-private interaction, the composition of their society or their business structure. So while Solo was a city where there was a devoted government leader and also a public sector which was incorporating a broad and balanced range of multi-sectoral, multi-ethnic, multi-scale firms, so quite a balanced setting, Manado was a local mayor which was closely linked to a handful of local firms. So this was rather an exclusive setting where three, four business tycoons, which were controlling much of the local economy, were quite closely linked to the mayor, not only the mayor, also to the governor. So it was a rather exclusive and, you could say, intransparent setting. So based on these different structures of these actors, and you could say also the different structures, and now the question was, what do we find? Do we find differences in investment climate reforms? Do we find differences in investment also and growth?
So how would you answer your own question?
By and large, we find that in both of these cities, Solo and Manado, there has been a rather informal relationship between the government and the private sector. But what is different, as I outlined, in Solo, it was much more inclusive, and in Manado, much more exclusive. Now, we find that investment, interestingly, is booming in the short term in pretty much both places. That's a surprising finding maybe for some observers, but there is a clear difference in investment climate reforms. So while in Manado investment was driven by exclusive, let's say, preferential treatments to a few powerful and rich firms, mainly constructing shopping malls, hotels, and different properties, in Manado, it was a much more balanced investment, which also involved the small and medium private sector development. They were restoring markets and also engaged former street traders and built new, smaller market compounds for them. But also, on the other hand, they had investment in property. So it was a bit more balanced investment story to be told here. And what we see in Solo, with a more inclusive setting, we find that investment climate reforms, so improvements of tax bills and the establishment of a one-stop service, and I mean just the efforts that have been made to make doing business more conducive have been distinctively better in Solo than in Manado. So bottom line, investment, at least in the short term, in both, but investment climate reforms, I mean, changing the rules of the game and then the regulations and procedures and practices have been much more improved in solo over these years.
So the listeners, I guess that some or maybe even many are now interested to read more about your research. So what is available in internet? Are these research studies that you mentioned, particularly the two about the political economy and investment climate as well as in relation to local governance, are they available in internet or at least are the abstracts of these studies?
I'm very happy if listeners send me email under cvlubke@stanford.edu, so cvlubke@stanford.edu. I also have a webpage at the Asia Pacific Research Center at Stanford, where you can find more information, and also at the Institute for Development Studies at www.ids.ac.uk, particularly under their subpage, the Center of the Future State, people can find more about our two-city comparison in Manado and Solo.
Great. Thank you very much, Christian.
Have a nice day. Bye.
And that's it for today's episode. Remember to send us your comments or your questions or suggestions for future shows to info@ledcast.net.